What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Now let's kick this thing off.
Darren Rovell is a sports business analyst who works for the Action Network. He previously worked for ESPN. Darren is also an avid sports memorabilia collector, along with various alternative assets. In this conversation, we discuss Bitcoin, decentralization, the value of autographs, and then Darren asked me a various hard questions about Bitcoin. Make sure you listen through the whole thing to see, does Darren go from skeptic to Bitcoin holder? Before we get into this episode, I want to quickly talk about our sponsors. First up is LMAX Digital. LMAX Digital is the number one institutional crypto exchange. They offer clients the deepest pool of crypto liquidity on the planet. It's underscored by 100% uptime track record through volatility spikes. Leveraging LMAX Group's liquidity relationships and ultra-low latency technology, LMAX Digital is the market-leading solution for institutional crypto trading and custodial services. They feature a central limit order book streaming spot Bitcoin, Ether, Litecoin, and Bitcoin Cash, all paired with US dollar, euro, and yen. Just cross-connect at the LD4 and over the internet to execute your crypto trading strategy with precision. LMAX Digital, the number one institutional crypto exchange. Never heard about them, it's probably because you're not an institution. LMAX Digital, secure, liquid, and trusted. Learn more by going to lmaxdigital.com/pomp. Again, lmaxdigital.com/pomp. Next up is Cosmos. They are building the Internet of Blockchains, marking a new era of interoperability, scalability, and usability. The free flow of assets and data between blockchains with bridges to Ethereum and Bitcoin will unleash the potential of DeFi, NFTs, and much more. Dive into Cosmos at cosmos.network/pomp. Again, cosmos.network/pomp. Go check out what Cosmos is building, the Internet of Blockchains, marking a new era of interoperability, scalability, and usability. cosmos.network/pomp. Last but not least is Matrixport. Have you lost your way in this low-yield environment while searching for a better store of value to beat inflation? Look no further. Invest with Matrixport to get out of your crypto and invest to earn high rates of return. Matrixport is Asia's fastest growing digital asset platform, founded by crypto veterans. With $10 billion in assets under management and custody, Matrixport offers one-stop crypto financial solutions, including fixed income, DeFi in one click, structured products, Cactus custody, spot OTC, and lending. You can earn from high single digits with fixed income to high double-digit yield with dual currency products. If you hold crypto and look for a yield, this app you don't want to miss. Go download the Matrixport app by going to invest.matrixport.com, or you can go and search in the App Store. Again, go download the app or go to invest.matrixport.com. All right, let's get in this episode with Darren. I hope you guys enjoy it.
Anthony Pompliano runs Pomp Investments. All views of him and the guests on his podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Pomp Investments. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp or his guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his personal opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
We got Darren Rovell, the infamous and the famous Darren Rovell, coming on the Best Business Show to get wild with us. Darren, what's going on, man?
What's up, guys? How are you?
We're great. How are you?
I am doing very well. What's up, my man, Joe? How are you?
Good. How are you? Thanks for coming on, Darren. We appreciate it, man.
I do my work only the night before, but I also do my work. I've listened to the entire show. So I heard your reference to the passing of the torch. No, I will not retire. But I will give Joe credit. He is a hard worker. His threads have obviously resonated on Twitter. He's been among the fastest growing guys on Twitter in a medium that has not grown that much. And so I give him a lot of credit. We have been covering the business of sports. I've been covering the business of sports for 21 years. It's a huge business and I haven't had enough competition. So in a friendly way, I welcome young Joe.
Darren, should Joe put out a breaking tweet right now? Breaking: Darren Rovell is not retiring.
I you know what? If Twitter had the dislike button, that would get slammed.
Darren and I were DMing back and forth the other day, talking about a story in sports business, and he sent me an article, and the date on it it came out. Darren wrote it when I was in like third grade.
I loved it. It was great.
It's great when you say, you know, hey, well, these athletes are finally getting paid in college. You know, I asked Carmelo Anthony in 2003. I mean, it's good in that way. But then, you know, when you think of when you Google and you're like, oh, my God, this story from 2001, you were on 20 years now. And I will say I'm not retiring, but social media over the past 10 years has made me a very tired man in general to wake up every morning, and Joe knows the exhaustion, wake up every morning ready to fight. to do that for a decade is really tiring.
Darren, can you tell us just the quick 30-second version? How did you get into reporting on business and money kind of behind sports? Like you, when I was growing up, you were the guy, right? You were the legend that knew all the everything about money. You knew all the players, everything. And you'd go on SportsCenter or other platforms and they would just turn to you and say, Darren, tell us about the money. How did you get into that?
So I always loved business. I love sports. I love business. And I didn't want to toil in a small market. I thought it was remarkable that no one was talking about the business of sports, yet it was hundreds of millions of dollars business. So I started a sports business radio show at Northwestern, and I quickly found out that athletes, everyone wants to talk to them, and they frankly don't want to talk to you for the most part. Whereas business people, the CEOs and everyone behind the scenes of the business of sports, I mean, you asked Drew Rosenhaus one question. There's your show. It's a full hour. They want to talk. And so when ESPN came to campus, I presented them with the idea of, you know, you not only have to be the worldwide leader in sports, you need to be the worldwide leader in sports business. And it was the internet. It was 2000. They gave this young kid a shot.
That's awesome. Let's go through the collections first. You told me that you have a large money collection. I'm not really sure what that means. And then
I think this is funny because you deal in money not being seen, right? Like, so it's funny that I have a check collection. So
that's why it's funny too.
So 5 years ago, I went to a show, a National Sports Collectors Convention, and a guy handed me a bunch of checks, and I had never collected a check before. And he said, they're all the same amount of money. And I was like, how does that make sense? Like, if it's like Denzel Washington paying for Hertz rent-a-car, how is that the same amount of money as Denzel Washington paying for his Lakers courtside seats? As a guy who loves the story, if there's a better story, why wouldn't it be more money if it had that greater story? So people collected checks just because they knew that the signature was more authentic because it's unlikely to forge a check. I started collecting checks because I love the story. So I'm going to show you a couple here and hopefully.
All right, let's do it.
You guys can see it. All right. Okay. Hold on. Let's get
the first National City Bank of New York.
Yeah, it's John F. God, these lights are horrible. Hold on, we gotta move the lights a little bit here. So this is John F. Kennedy paying for his Washington Post subscription 3 months before he became president.
Wow, how'd you get this one?
There were 13 JFK checks that are known, and this was the one that I had my eye on for a while over the last 2 or 3 years. Went to auction, and I bought it. This is a great one. I think you'll like this. I don't know. God.
Yep. There you go.
Disney. So this is Walt Disney paying a quarter of his taxes in 1962.
Wow. $10,000.
Yeah. He was basically at $43,000, $44,000 in 1962. And that signature is amazing. So I love that one. Then I wanted to get a Babe Ruth check. And I spoke to a guy who had access to these things. And I said, okay, I need one of three things. I need him paying a prostitute, eating too much, or drinking too much. And the guy luckily did find me a check where Babe Ruth was at least buying alcohol. It's the Park Circa Liquor Shops, which is still on 38th and Madison. $502 in 1940, which is about $13,000 worth of alcohol. And that's a nice Babe Ruth. And then I'll quickly show you. I don't want to spend a whole time on this because I want to understand Bitcoin from you. And I want to ask you some challenging questions, or at least what I think are challenging, maybe not for you. As I mentioned, this is the, this is,
LA Lakers.
LA Lakers. It's Denzel Washington paying for his Lakers courtside seats the first year of the Staples Center in 1999 when they won the title. It just goes on. Joe Montana paying for his sophomore year apartment in Notre Dame. You get the Joseph C. Montana. Not likely to get that. Are you guys Boston guys or no?
No, we're New York Giants fans. Best football team New York Giants in the world.
All right. So we got Jackie Robinson paying for the rent check for the apartment he was in when he broke the color barrier.
So Darren, how many items do you have? How much is it all worth? And where do you keep all this stuff? Is it all like, I don't want to
under his bed.
No,
I mean, I never say how much it's worth, although I did enjoy the question that you asked, does Jeff Bezos know how much he's worth? And I would agree that the answer is no. I would want to know how close he would be if we had the number and he were to guess. But I do know I keep a database of what I have, what it's worth now. There are very few things in my house, so don't try to go rob my house. There's a gun safe bolted. This is interesting. I mean, when you're looking for storage of high end items, it's difficult. You know, I have a lot of stuff at an art storage facility. You just have to know where to go. And sometimes I have to pull things but I kind of like to see things. So I go visit these places and take them out. It's not like I'm putting it in a safety deposit box in a bank and saying, I know I have it.
Are we talking hundreds of items, thousands, tens of thousands?
We're talking about, I mean, I have, let's say 100 really blow you away quality items.
Gotcha.
Which one is your favorite?
In 1963, Martin Luther King got purposely arrested in Birmingham with his right-hand man, Ralph Abernathy. And he wrote Letters from a Birmingham Jail, which was cobbled together from the letters from the jail to the outside, and someone put it together. This was 3 months before I Have a Dream. The letter was remarkable, although it doesn't get the credit it gets because it wasn't an oration like I Have a Dream. I own the warden's logbooks from the Birmingham jail, which has 12 Martin Luther King signatures of him signing in and out his mail, which he then used to give the letters to the outside.
So Darren, most of these things, whether it's the checks, the logbooks, etc., it seems like people have this fascination with signatures. Why is it that signature is so valuable in your opinion on these items? Or like if you had the logbook without a signature, it would be worth less. So like what is it about the signature that drives so much value?
I mean, it depends what signatures, but yes, people like signatures. I think it depends on, you know, what it's on a lot more. I am in general not interested in signatures, but if you tell me that you could get Tiger Woods' signature on a 1997 Masters badge, well, and the signature is from 1997 to 99. And by the way, that's determined by the fact that his signature changed in 2000. So there's a lot of nuance to this, but I think people in general like signatures. I'm more tied to, like, I have four or five Martin Luther King signatures. They are all from 1963. Because I think that's the year. And, you know, so these markets, by the way, are fairly illiquid, but I never worry about it because I think that some of the pieces I have and collect are so remarkable and I have the ability to tell the story that it doesn't matter that 100,000 people don't want it. You know, so right now I'm collecting tickets and there's probably 10,000 ticket collectors that just absolutely love tickets versus 20 million people that love cards. People say, oh, but it's not as liquid as cards. Doesn't concern me because if I'm getting the best pieces in the world, there'll be people to buy it.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right. Signatures on physical items. You just described how Tiger Woods changed his signature, which is wild stat by itself or piece of.
No. Actually not. I mean, changed it like a little bit, almost maybe unknowingly.
What is the difference?
There's less of a curve to it. In one of the, like, athletes in their course of their career usually change their signature in a way that you would know, or at least the people who collect would know, 4 to 6 times.
Wow. And is that on purpose, or that they're just, their hand changes, they get tired of signing stuff?
Yeah, I mean, now these guys, I mean, it used to be Harmon Killebrew, you know, and Willie Mays, and some of these guys had tremendous autographs, and now you get like Mello Ball looks exactly like, you know,
I saw the video
the Bridges one. Yeah, I mean, it's like they're MB. Yeah, gee, thanks. I mean, like, some of these things. Now, if the guy's collectible, so I hate Lin-Manuel Miranda's signature, but I do collect dollar bills. So Lin-Manuel putting the goatee on Hamilton, even though, I mean, look at that, Lin, that's signature ball. But you put the goatee on Hamilton, you know, like, that's next level.
What is it? Wait, hold on a second. Hold on. What's your signature look like?
My signature's damn good. Because on Twitter about 10 years ago, I started critiquing athlete signatures, and I was like, you know what? Even when I'm an E-list celebrity, but I'm like, now every time I sign even a receipt at a restaurant, it is bona fide, incredible signature.
Yeah, if you give it out, you got to be ready to have a good signature yourself.
Yep. I got $2 for you. Ready? All so right. We got Jay-Z on a hundo. Oh, on a
Benjamin. How much was that? How much was that you had to pay for it? You remember?
I paid $1,300 for this. I just think, you know, I think Jay-Z is going to get hard. I do focus on guys that are going to get harder and harder. Hold on one second. So
Darren Rovell has left the interview.
So this is if you see on this side or on this side, it says Customers Rule Jeff Bezos. It's one of his nicest signatures, and it's on the 1999 Time Person of the Year. I bought this the day he stepped down was stepping down as Amazon CEO, because I just thought to myself, how much harder is it going to be to get him? He's going to go from private jet to private island. It's going to be impossible. Jay-Z is one of those guys who's going to get harder and harder. I have a ton of Buffett. I have the largest Warren Buffett signature in the world. Whatever that's worth. But it's guys who are going to get harder. And now I will tell you, Elon Musk is a real, real one that I haven't figured out yet. I have no Elon Musk pieces for one reason. One, he has signed cars and pictures on the way to, like, when he's going somewhere, he has signed, he has stood. And I also think he's a big enough of a freak that I start collecting. Like, if I collect Gates, I didn't account for the Epstein connection, but when I collect Gates and Buffett and those guys, like, I don't think they're going to change. Musk, like, one day could do like a free autograph signing for like 20,000 people. Like, I don't know what that dude's going to do. So I right now I'm uncomfortable investing in him.
I don't think that Elon Musk is going to do that, just for the record.
But he might do something more extensive than anything that those
True. All right. Before we get into the Bitcoin stuff, I want you to tell us, how did you prepare for this? We need to know what we're going into here. Did you do a practice debate? Did you read online? What did you do to prepare?
I enlisted a guy named Alex Holmes, who is who has Bitcoin mining machines.
Yep.
He was on the USC championship football teams, offensive lineman. He is as crazy Bitcoin as possible.
Okay.
Threatened during our conversation last night, I threatened to end it more than 5 times because I was so enraged.
All right. What are your questions?
I was in crypto for 41 days total. I feel like I need to say this. I was in crypto for 41 days total. I netted probably around, I don't know, over $100,000, mostly in ETH through horse sales. I bought $93,000 worth of horses in Zed Run, and I sold it for more than double I was out in mid-May when ETH was at the highest or near the highest. Just following that, and I am a gambler at heart, and the volatility made me sick. I don't care whether it's on paper or if I'm down 16 grand and it's on paper, it's just as bad as me being down 16 grand for good. That's just how my head works. So I just felt like I need to explain that I did deep dive. And when I deep dive, I do deep dive. And I have learned as much as I can about this. I have your newsletter. I read your newsletter. I often don't get to the bottom because I'm so angry.
All right. What are your, let's start from the top. And it's 12:33 right now. By 1 o'clock, you're going to tell me you're going to buy Bitcoin. Let's start from the top. What are the questions that you have? You have a notebook full of questions.
Okay. So you say that Bitcoin is innovative, right? But at the same time, it hasn't evolved and it's irreplaceable. So to me, that's like the Kodak guys saying, this is a great innovation. This Polaroid camera, but then saying there's nothing beyond the Polaroid camera because this is it. So how do you have something that is both innovative and at the same time doesn't change and is irreplaceable?
So good question. I feel like I'm being cross-examined by a prosecutor right now.
I give you a ton of credit here because I'm going to ask you some good questions here and I'm excited.
This is a very good question. There's two different ways to look at innovation. The first is what I'll call like the 0 to 1 of the creation of Bitcoin. So the ability to actually create a decentralized digital currency. There's plenty of other attempts at digital currencies in the past. None of them had been successful around creating a decentralized digital currency. When you think of when you're creating technology, you can either choose to pursue security and resilience, or you can choose to pursue speed, innovation, etc. Bitcoin's initial creation understood decentralization as the single most important aspect of what we're going to go do. There are nation state concerns. There is the ability where people will want to control the monetary policy of this, make changes, et cetera. So decentralization was the pursuit. The leveraging of proof of work, which had been created before, the difficulty adjustment of the Bitcoin block reward, and then actually just the structure of Bitcoin itself created kind of a confluence of events that put Bitcoin into the world. It's gone from zero to $800+ billion in economic value in 12 years, right? Absolutely insane. So that was kind of a 0 to 1 moment. Now, along the path or the ethos of keeping security, resilience, decentralization, Bitcoin is intentionally very, very secure, methodical, and intentional about the development process. So I'm sure you've seen a bunch of the issues in like the DeFi world where there's been hacks of large amounts of money, et cetera. Some of
Bitcoin is set up to be is irreplaceable in the fact that it's set up through their system to be the most complex system that you cannot replace. I understand that.
It's basically the thing that has the highest likelihood of being here 100 years from now. So because there's $800 billion or so of economic value that's at stake, we have to be very methodical about the software process. And so there actually has been a lot of updates, a lot of innovation that's occurred. So for example, there was a recent update called Taproot, which basically was a software update to the actual Bitcoin protocol that was adopted by everyone in the ecosystem. And it increased things like lower cost, more privacy, et cetera. So that's a layer 1 type innovation. On top of that, there's been innovation in the overall system with things like layer 2. So go back, you had some dollar bills there, right? If you go back to the US dollar system, gold was the original layer 1 technology, right? It for 5,000 years served as money. Really hard to carry around, really hard to use to pay for things, hard to send to people, et cetera. So what did we do? We created a layer 2 on top of the gold to make it easier to transact. Paper claims of gold, right? Dollars backed by gold. So now you leave the gold in the vault, you walk around with the paper and you can exchange it pretty easily with people. And if they ever want the gold, they can go back and they can get it out of the vault until 1971. And eventually there was layer 3, layer 4, layer 5, right? Things like credit, electronic money, et cetera. But it was all built on that layer 1 of the secure gold.
Okay, can I cut you off?
Of course.
I think that's a good answer. I don't know if I understood it all. You're really good at talking about this, but I'm not sure if it makes sense or not. I'm not sure, but I want to hit on the decentralized part. So you said the important part about this was the decentralized nature of it all. Okay. So the new people that are in Bitcoin, at least from anecdotally who I've talked to, do not give a flying about the decentralization part of it. In fact, with most people I talk to, it's actually not a positive. Now, I know you talk about the government versus us and, you know, all that. And that's what propagates the we want this to be decentralized. But and I'm not saying this isn't important. There's a lot of people who either don't care about the decentralized portion of it or don't want it to be decentralized because it's fucking scary.
Yeah.
Go.
So I think that it's important to understand what is the value proposition of Bitcoin. The value proposition is that Bitcoin is a store of value that is based on a transparent programmatic monetary policy, right? If I asked you how many dollars are coming in circulation today, you can't tell me. If I ask you what's the next policy decision in the US dollar system, you can't tell me.
It's transparent because it's all on the ledger and everything has to be seen, but it's not, and we'll talk about taxes later, but it's transparent because of that, but it's doesn't seem to be transparent. I mean, the idea of it being decentralized and not connected to anything and founded by a person who we didn't know.
So hold on a second. So transparent programmatic monetary policy. And the reason why that's important is because sound money principles, which gold and Bitcoin both hold, are the idea that it's outside the system and no one can create more of that asset, right? So no one controls it. Gold is the analog application. It's the physical version of sound money principles. Bitcoin takes a lot of those same principles, the sound money principles, and applies it in a digital product. What I mean by that is 21 million total, and we know every single monetary policy decision that's already happened. We know every single transaction. I can literally show it to you since January 3rd, 2009. And then we know exactly what's happening right now. 900 Bitcoin will come into circulation today. And we also know every future monetary policy decision in the future. I can show you everything on a blockchain. Now, why is that important, right? That's the value proposition. Why is it important? Well, when you compare it to the existing system, what you see is it's 180 degree difference. Fiat currencies are inflationary and they're completely unpredictable, right? That's both true in the United States and elsewhere. Bitcoin is the opposite. It is a fixed supply asset and it is completely predictable. If you think of the role of a central bank, there's basically—
Okay, by the way, that's where I'm like about to slam the door here, okay?
All right,
so,
why?
So this is what enrages me.
Okay.
The completely predictable part, okay. So we have 21 million Bitcoin.
Correct.
And we know the supply and we know about the halving and we know it will be less and less and less all the way to what is it?
Zero.
2000.
Till 2140.
2140. Okay. So we know that. But where, so when I talk to Alex and I listen to you, it's a foregone conclusion that this is going to go to 100 and up and up and up. It has to because there's no replacement for it, and there will be more demand for it. And that drives me nuts because I've taken economic classes, and I want to know where an Adam Smith and any economist that has ever said anything, has anyone said that you can guarantee a system whereby it will definitely over time only go up?
So this is a great question, right? And you're the perfect person to talk to this about because you understand supply and demand better than almost anybody else, right? The difference is, remember what you said about Elon Musk? You said, I don't want to buy Elon Musk's signatures because I'm scared that he may go do a signing of 20,000, you know, pieces. Okay. And so all of a sudden the supply would move on me, right? I can't predict the supply. What Bitcoin has that is different than any other asset in the world is that Bitcoin supply is known with certainty. So forget price. Price is not certain, but the supply is certain. 21 million total. We know the halving schedule. We know exactly how many will come in. And so from a circulating supply and total supply, we know with certainty. when you have one side of a supply demand equation that is known and proven.
That's nice. Yeah, that's nice. But you guys talk about as if you know that demand is a foregone.
Okay, so this is the key part, is when you know supply and you can prove it. It's not just knowing what's going to happen. It's being able to verify it, prove it, right? When you know that with certainty and can prove it, then the only thing you need to be able to look at or extrapolate is demand. Now, demand is not known, right? We do not know if demand for Bitcoin is going to go up or down.
Talk about it as if you know.
Okay, hold on a second. Hold on. So think about it probabilistically, right? If you think of it as, is it more likely that Bitcoin demand goes up or down in the future? Well, there's a couple of different ways you can analyze.
I don't know.
Okay. Well, so let me walk you through a couple of things I think, and you can disagree with them. One is, if you look at it as a pure technology, as a network, right? What you end up finding is that money is one of the most viral technology products in the world. Because what happens is, in order for the money to be valuable to me, I need to be able to send it to other people, and they need to be able to send it to me. And so things like PayPal or Cash App, et cetera, and also things like Bitcoin are very viral because they involve money. So if you look at just as a structure, it is more likely that it will be a viral product than not. If you then look at it in terms of economics, Bitcoin today, having that finite supply and a transparent programmatic monetary policy, being the exact opposite of kind of the chaotic monetary policy in the fiat system, it is likely, not guaranteed, but likely that people will seek something to store value in if the currency that they denominate their life in is being devalued at a historic rate.
Okay. I got that. Now, I need to get to this because my eye is on the time. And believe me, we have 17 minutes here. Okay. the next issue is that we talk about the inhuman nature of Bitcoin. Okay. We talk about the fact that it's not affected by humans, right? Like, it's not controlled like the Fed. That's your main concern. Look what the Fed's doing, pumping out more and more money. It's inflationary. This is a disaster. Bitcoin is not affected by humans. I've heard that. And that's also one of the most outrageous, egregious things I could ever imagine, because at least right now, maybe it wasn't so much affected by humans in the first 8 years of its life cycle. But in 2021, baby, I could tie what Elon Musk said, what China did when they shut down their machines. I could tie every single news data point to where Bitcoin went. And so to me, it's like, you guys say that this is the benefit is it's non-human. And then all of a sudden I'm thinking, well, it's a hell of a lot more human manipulated than the dollar.
So think about this for a second. There's two different ways to look at this conversation. Let's start with the monetary policy, the structure of it. Nobody controls it. Nobody can change it. No one's ever changed it. No one will ever change it, because everyone would have to agree, or majority of people would have to agree.
Yep.
So the structure, the monetary policy, is immune to human emotions of greed, fear, politics, etc. What you're talking about is the US dollar exchange price, right? Which basically means Bitcoin was worth 60,000. Now it's worth 40,000. In a world that is denominated in dollars, there is volatility. There's also volatility in dollars, right? If you were to invert it and say, okay, the dollar denominated in Bitcoin has been crashing aggressively for a decade. Now, in the last 12 months—
Whoa, wait, can I stop?
Yeah.
Crashing aggressively. So you talk a lot of, I'm gonna let you go. You talk a lot about America, which to me, I understand your sponsors are in America. This is an American audience. But like, I totally get Bitcoin in Nicaragua and Argentina. I mean, God, I mean, they got nothing. The bank means nothing. But in America, like it doesn't, even if there's inflation, it doesn't seem like it's a foregone conclusion that inflation and Bitcoin are related or in any way. Nor does it seem to me that like we are headed to a point where Bitcoin is going to become the next currency and replace fiat. So,
all right, let me get through a couple of these things, right? So first is, in the United States, the financial position of Americans is way worse than anyone understands. 78% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. 45% of Americans have no investable assets. So they're the people who get hurt the most by the inflation, right? Stanley Druckenmiller has gone on CNBC multiple times and said, listen, the Fed is the greatest contributor to wealth inequality because when they print money, people who hold assets get richer, right? Everyone that we know that holds assets has gotten rich beyond their wildest dreams in the last 12, 15 months. Stock market hitting all-time highs, you know, all that type of stuff. Bitcoin as well, every asset goes up. The people who get hurt are the people who live paycheck to paycheck and have all of their wealth in cash. So what you get is this massive divergence in the two kind of populations, if you will. And so ultimately what happens is don't think of Bitcoin as replacing the dollar from a the government is going to ask me to pay in Bitcoin for tax purposes for right now. Right. Just simply think of it.
Isn't that the main point to when the hodlers, holders decide to really isn't it out of all the things? That here's the thing and the flow, yep. And it's on the third time I'm going to hit it at the high. And I'm like, it's so obvious. Why would if everyone knows that you're hitting at the high of the next half, what's the deal? It's like Jerry Seinfeld. Okay. But what I just don't understand like how it works.
Hold on. So think about this is your grandparents, my grandparents, my great grandparents would tell you and I, save. That was the advice financially, right? Was spend less than you make, stay out of debt and save. And before 1971, you literally could save your way to financial security, right? That was possible because there wasn't a massive devaluation of the currency. Today, it is impossible to save, right? If you look at somewhere like a Chipotle, where they gave a 3-4% wage increase to their workers, CPI is at 5+%, right? So it doesn't even account for the actual inflation. And so you can't save your way. So what has happened is we've seen all these investors push further and further out on the risk curve. They're YOLOing into stocks, collectibles, Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, everything that is like the madness of the markets is because people can't simply just buy bonds or hold cash, right? And so when you get to that world, it's almost this crazy thing where we ask a teacher to go to school and be a great teacher and then go home and be a professional investor, right? That's the only way to keep your purchasing power, which is insane. You think it's insane. Everyone thinks that's insane. What Bitcoin provides is basically a savings account. It's an asset where you simply just save. And as you save, what happens is because of that structure and that finite component to it, the US dollar exchange price has to go up as long as there is more and more people that want it. Now, what is the most interesting part about the Bitcoin market? I don't know if you know this or not, but you can see on chain, which is basically that open ledger, how many Bitcoin are being held by people who historically have never sold. And that number is usually over 50%. So right now there's 18 to 19 million. There's about 19 million Bitcoin or so in circulation. It's like 18.8 million, I think. And that 18.8 million in the last 12 months is held by 70% of that is held by people who don't sell. They're called strong hands. So you literally have 18.8 million in the market, but 70% of them or so are being held by people who are those long-term hodlers. And so when institutions or public companies show up and say, hey, I want to buy Bitcoin, they go to these exchanges and they say, hey, I'll pay you $10,000 for your Bitcoin. And the Bitcoiners say, I'm not selling it. Then they say 15,000. I'm not selling. 20, 30, 40.
So this also drives me nuts, right? So you have, it will only go up. The demand will only go up. So it's going to only go up. And then it's the hodlers, holders. Again, I'm not beholden to these economic textbooks, okay? But no one's ever said that you should always hold over time. Why did I sell my baseball cards in February and it just turned out that it was 3 days away from what was the high in the market? Because it just seemed too obvious for me. I was uncomfortable. The idea of holding is a cult-like activity that in previous worlds just does not make any economic sense. And it's unique to this Bitcoin crypto market, which to, I think, a rational person like myself makes absolutely no sense.
Okay. So it's a fair critique. Let me put it in a different perspective, and I think it'll make more sense. If I said to you, name a meme stock, the first one that you would tell me is GameStop AMC, one of the ones that Correct. We've recently talked about. I would argue that Berkshire Hathaway is a meme stock, right? There is a leader, Warren Buffett. People go on Mecca to Omaha every year to talk to him. They are disciples of Warren.
It has cultish type properties. Right. I agree with you
there. So Berkshire Hathaway, AMC, same story, different generations.
It's not the same story because AMC, everyone knows that the popcorn is still ingrained in their red carpet from 1983. And fair. They know that. And they know that while Warren Buffett has said, buy what you know, he has done some great deals with insurance companies and transportation. There is actually fundamentals behind it.
I'm talking AMC about the psychological component.
I get it.
Okay. So those are very similar, just different generations. Historically, people would buy real estate and would say, never sell the real estate. The real estate will always go up in value because it's actually the dollar being devalued against it, right? Now, what these people are doing
it's a hedge.
Yeah, as hodlers, is they're basically buying digital real estate is a way to look at it. So there's 21 million lots in this digital ledger. How many do you own? Right. And so just like you wouldn't sell the real estate or day trade the real estate or say, hey, you know what? I think it's high in February. Let me buy it back in March. Right. Because it just doesn't make sense to do that with real estate. The same thing's happening here. And so ultimately, one of the things that Bitcoiners say, which this is going to be crazy for you to hear at first, but just think through it for a second.
Oh, I've heard a lot of crazy things.
Bitcoin actually embodies the timeless investing principles. It's basically dollar cost average in. Don't look at price and sell and hold for really, really long periods of time. And if you buy a great asset and hold it for a long period of time, you will do well when it comes to wealth generation.
But see, the problem is Bitcoin is so young that that's why it comes off as a tactic. Real estate is not young. Bitcoin is. And so it's like, oh, it's look, let me show you the chart of the last 10 years. How can you argue with this? It's the last 10 years and it's the first 10 years. And I can show you a chart and I know it's the first 10. So it means a little bit more, the first 12, whatever that chart is. But I can show you a beautiful chart of Blockbuster from 1985 to 1995.
So here is a great way to look at it. In 1971 is the creation of fiat currency. And that fiat currency is only 50 years old, right? We just had the 50 year anniversary of the Nixon speech. Bitcoin is 12, so it's younger than the fiat currency. If you look in 1971 at what happened to gold, it was at like $35 or whatever, and now it's trading at $1,600, $1,700. So the world repriced gold once it was unpegged. My belief is that the world at that time was trying to price what is a global store of value, right? And so gold was a global store of value. It ended up pricing it where it is today. I think Bitcoin's going through the same thing, which is in the first 12 years, it explodes. You're not going to get the same returns in the next 12 years that you got in the first 12 years, obviously, right? There's more distributed ownership, all that type of stuff. But what I do think is that Bitcoin, which historically has grown at, let's say, 200% compound annual growth for a decade, maybe that comes down and it's 150 or 100 or whatever the number is.
But it could be negative. It could be zero. I mean, like,
well, the only way that it would be zero is that you would have to basically have no more increasing demand. So the whole thesis,
it is possible, even though Bitcoin itself is not replaceable to the exact T, right? I buy that. You cannot replace Bitcoin to the computer systems, how everything's back ended. Fine. But maybe there is something that is like that, that people simply want. You always talk about, the digital currency, the quick transaction on the ledger. If that did become a currency and we did more of that, like, I don't know, like, I know I'm a 43-year-old guy, but like, I kind of like the 100 days where I can get my money back on Apple Pay. And I know you can say, well, then we'll pay you. If there's a problem, we'll pay you back. And it's the young, fast transactions. But like, again, like, it seems to me, and I know we're almost done here. It seems to me that people say, if they're in Bitcoin or crypto, they say it's not comparable to anything except when it is convenient to compare.
So there's definitely tons of what I'll call intellectual manipulation that goes on because people are trying to explain it. They're trying to compare it. There's also a spectrum of people who are very sophisticated and can explain it well. And then those who are trying their best, et cetera. It's like, that's true in any market. What I would say is the comparison between Bitcoin and, let's say, Apple Pay is a comparison of technologies from a payments perspective. What the true Bitcoiners, I think, wrap their head around and kind of hold on to is Bitcoin is different from a monetary policy standpoint. So forget for a second which transaction is faster or, you know, does a store accept Apple Pay or not, whatever. The difference is the 180 degree kind of opposite ends of the spectrum of Bitcoin being a transparent programmatic monetary policy versus an unpredictable one. And so ultimately what you have to do is you have to get to from a sequence of events. You can't be a true good medium of exchange unless first you're a good store of value. You can't be a true good medium or a store of value unless you are a super secure decentralized system in today's digital world. And so what I think is going to happen here is these central bank digital currencies, this is, you know, the digital dollar, et cetera. Those are technology innovations, but the monetary policy is the exact same, right? What Bitcoin did was it innovated on monetary policy.
Will it be possible to have a centralized, obviously it won't run exactly as Bitcoin, but is it possible that a replacement is a centralized coin?
So what I think ends up happening is every single country in the world that has a fiat currency is going to create a digital version. So there will be a digital dollar, digital euro, digital yuan, et cetera.
China is doing that, right?
They're all doing it. The problems with that, I think there's three problems. One is you drastically increase financial surveillance. Right now, if I want to know what's in your bank account, I got to go to a FISA court or whatever and get an order to subpoena your bank records, right? If they control the system, they can see in your account and what everything you spend on. Really scary stuff, especially in authoritarian countries, but even here in the US. The second thing is that they can personalize the monetary policy. So everything in your life is personalized, your news feed, your search results, your music playlist, your Google Maps, everything. If all of a sudden I can say Darren gets a high rate of inflation and Pomp doesn't, or Darren has to experience something from a monetary policy standpoint and Pomp doesn't, scary. The third thing is, and China just ran a test here, and we have it in the US with EBT cards, is what if they make the money expire? So say, we're gonna move to a UBI system, and every month Darren's gonna get $1,200, but he must spend it in the first 30 days or it disappears. Now, all of a sudden, you lose sovereignty, right? You lose control. It becomes a more authoritarian system. And so all of that will be possible. I'm not saying that they're gonna do it.
I agree, that makes sense, but also, some people are more comforted in an authoritative system than a system that has nothing and no one running it.
Okay. Agreed.
We got a minute. I got two more things. I am not going to invest in Bitcoin yet. I mean, this would take another couple hours. But my two last things, and I'll leave the floor to you for the last bit. You talk about inflation, and the one thing about inflation that people think about is erratic volatility. And isn't Bitcoin, at least in the last 6 to 10 months, more erratic than the American dollar? And that's one. And then two, why do you feel the need? Why do all people who invest in Bitcoin feel the need that they need to talk about it and pump it up? Why is it part of like a multi-level marketing scheme? Why is that part of the deal when I buy Bitcoin? Why do I have to pump it up? Why does Pomp on June 26, 2019, say there's a 75% chance that it's going to reach 100,000 by 2021. Why is there that need? That's my final thing.
All right.
And I know
inflation.
So we might have to do another one.
Inflation, dollars guaranteed to go down in value. Guaranteed. There's not very many things guaranteed in life. Guaranteed dollar will lose value every single year. Second thing on inflation is that if you look over the last 6-7 months, Bitcoin has appreciated. It was $30,000 on January 1st, and now it's sitting at $45,000, $46,000. The dollar has been devaluing. So over 12 months, 6 months, 10 years, 5 years, everything, the dollar has gone down, Bitcoin has gone up in value. So Bitcoin protects and increases your purchasing power while the dollar does the exact opposite. Two completely different kind of structured systems.
If you're a rational person, you want to throw up every day from the roller coaster.
Agreed. If you look at the US dollar price. Now, what we didn't get to, and maybe we'll do a different conversation around, is if all of a sudden everything is priced in the currency, so dollars, you don't realize that the dollar is volatile. You just see that, prices went up a little bit, right? That's the only way you see any level of inflation. You don't realize that the dollar lost 10, 15, 20%, whatever.
There's not a metric every day on how devalued
exactly.
The dollar is.
So
the CPI comes
if out. Everything was denominated in Bitcoin, you wouldn't see US dollar exchange price volatility. You would just see whether the price of things are going up or down. over the last 10 years, everything's been getting cheaper. If you denominate your life in Bitcoin, everything getting more expensive in dollars. So let's put that in a box and we'll put that to the side. The second thing is, I think most people who hold Bitcoin, what ends up happening, I say it all the time, is Bitcoin taught me economics and it taught me personal finance. I got an economics degree. I didn't learn anything in college, right? But I got the degree. I got a piece of paper. I'm supposed to know all this stuff. It's not until I bought Bitcoin that I really started to understand money. And there's this belief that like people come for the profits. They think they're going to get rich. That's what pulls people into Bitcoin or cryptocurrency. They think they're going to get rich. Not everyone, but a lot of people. But ultimately, they start to hold the asset and they start to learn economics. They start to learn about personal finance. They start to learn about the dollar, Bretton Woods, inflation, all these things. And they start to understand, wow, why was I not taught this in high school and or college or after I graduated? And what they're doing is they're not so much talking about Bitcoin, I think. I think what they're doing is they're actually talking about calling out kind of the charade that goes on in the legacy system. Now, what they say is, hey, Bitcoin's the solution. Bitcoin fixes this, you know, whatever your favorite example is. But I don't think it's about talking so much about Bitcoin as it is highlighting the issues in the legacy system.
Okay.
Are you going to buy Bitcoin?
I will buy. You know what? To honor you for having the balls to have me on, I will buy some Bitcoin. I'll receive it in 10 days because I'm going to go through Coinbase. I will buy a nominal amount of Bitcoin, and it will be in your name. I will honor you by doing that today because I appreciate you having me on and allowing you to ask some of the tough questions.
Listen, we're going to do this again because I actually enjoyed doing this. But the next request that I have,
I think it's good for, by the way, I think it's good for you too.
Of
like
course.
You can't have, I mean, to have some critics every once in a while.
Darren, do you see the laser eyed bull? Do you see the laser eyed bull right here? Let's go. Yeah.
You want to go? If you hold the bull by the horns, you'll be grabbing your nipples.
All right. Where can we send people to find you on the internet or find more?
Darren Revelle on Twitter, Darren Revelle on Instagram. I'm sure I'll have a lot of people screaming and yelling at me. Listen, for the record, for those scoring at home, I didn't kill Pomp. Pomp didn't kill me. I know that when I go look at my Twitter, it'd be like, oh, Pomp wrecked him. It was like, you know, the judges are always against me.
Darren, I actually think people are going to appreciate you doing this. I think that you came with good questions. You did your homework. You were open-minded and you're even buying Bitcoin. So that'll make some people happy. I think they'll enjoy it.
Awesome, Joe.
All right, Darren, wait, two last things real quick. One, do you want to give a shout out to Athletic Brewing?
Yeah, hells yeah. I wish I was drinking one right now. We are rocking and rolling. I'm glad that they sponsor the huddle and Joe's endeavor. Non-alcoholic beer, man, is, you know, I've been a believer from the get-go. People on Twitter say that it's my brand. I don't care. You can look at my bank account later.
All right, that's first. Second of all, can you do the virtual passing of the torch just for fun?
Sure.
I'll take it.
Love you, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Darren.
Right,
you got it. Take care, guys.
Later.